I'm Shane Morris. Thanks for listening to the Breakpoint Podcast. Today we have cold case detective and Christian apologist J. Warner Wallace's presentation at the 2018 William Wilberforce Weekend on the topic of training our children in the faith. Wallace sheds new light on why so many young people leave the faith and explains how instead of teaching our kids about the faith, we need to train them in the faith. Otherwise, they won't be prepared to meet the challenges to their faith they will inevitably face. Here's J. Warner Wallace.
Well, I just got off the phone doing a radio interview related to this shooting. There's 10 dead students right now in Santa Fe, Texas, and we're just talking about how these kinds of investigations move forward. And it is something that really requires you to think about everything, including the problem of evil, through your Christian worldview, through the lens of a Christian worldview. And I think sometimes when people ask me that question, well, how are they going to proceed? What are the first steps they're going to make? They're really asking an investigative question, but I want to answer it in a spiritual way that really is coming richly, hopefully richly, from my Christian worldview. I think the reason why they ask me these questions is because they know I've been working these kinds of cases for about 30 years. Most of them are unsolved murders. I work murders that don't get solved. If you like Dateline, you've probably seen my cases because I've been on Dateline more than any other detective in the country, just solving murders because there's no statute of limitations for a murder. Those things stay open. You can do a robbery and get away with it. You can do a burglary and get away with it. You can do anything and get away with it, but when it comes to murder, we leave those open. Now, all the time that I was working in these investigations, we have another Dateline we're filming in next Thursday, every time I've done an investigation like this, I mean, for all the years I was doing this professionally, I was also working as a youth pastor because my heart was in, my kids were young. My kids were high schoolers at the time when I first started working as a youth pastor. And I wanted to be able to kind of, I guess, interact with the most important generation in the church, which I felt were young people. So I hired two interns about 20 hours a week, and I started youth pastoring. I was in seminary for 7 years trying to get that degree, right? While I was working cold cases, which have almost no limit in terms of the amount of time they'll ask you to give to that cause, well, in the end, I learned a few things, and I want to share those with you right now. I was asked a couple of years ago to do a short scene in a movie called God's Not Dead 2. And they gave me 6 minutes to make a case for why the New Testament is reliable. And I thought at the time, that's hard, right? And so I'm trying to write out what 6 minutes I would try to give them. And then I thought about it from the perspective of our young people who are Christians, who are, you know, 6 minutes is more time than they're ever going to get to defend what they believe on Twitter or on Facebook or on Instagram or on Snapchat. They're not going to get 6 minutes with people. Instead, they're going to get bombarded with views that they're going to have to learn how to respond to. And I know for me, to give you a 6-minute response means that I have to master about 10 years of material to decide which 6 minutes are appropriate for this setting. Does that make sense? We're all doing that, right? And so what I'm going to try to do is share some material from a book I wrote called Forensic Faith. This is my shameless plug for a book right here. But really, it breaks down into 4 attributes that I think first responders have that if we had these as Christians, we'd be better equipped to respond to culture. And today, I'm just going to talk about one of these. It is this idea of training, of targeted training. We're talking on the Fox today about this. They want to know, well, you know, what do you think of people who are armed security at schools? Part of the problem with some of the security we have at schools is that it's usually guys like me who have spent 30 years and now we're retired and we'll hire on to do some school security. As in fact, one of the officers that was there today was shot in the shoulder. He is a retired police officer from Houston PD who is now working on the school grounds. And I will tell you that I think that's important. To have armed security is going to be important going forward. It just is. But of course, the problem is you don't want someone like me at 57. You want me at 27. You want me when I was back there working in the SWAT team. Because at that moment, I actually had the kinds of weapon training and the kinds of tactical training you would need. Because let's face it, in a school shooting, if you're working as an officer at a school, you're in an all or nothing situation. You're basically doing nothing, or you're involved in stopping a mass school shooting. You're either doing nothing or you're doing the most important thing you could ever do. That's really where you are. And at that moment, you don't want me, not me at 57. You want me when I was younger. We're going to have to start thinking about the preparation that's required for that kind of officer, right? Because when you're in this situation, you're constantly trying to prepare yourself. You are staying in great physical shape. I was the best shot of my life while those 3 years I worked SWAT. Also, we were constantly practicing. We would create scenarios to practice in. We were jumping off anything that was a fixed object, we would jump off of it. I don't even know why we did that. I never ever once had to jump off for an entry, a real life entry, okay? We only jumped in practice, but we would do it because you just don't know when you're going to have to do it. I actually think that this kind of preparation is important for all of us if we're going to call ourselves Christ followers in this generation. Now, the first three speakers are all close friends of mine. And I will tell you that they kind of took you at 30,000 feet and gave you some great philosophical underpinning of what it is we're facing as a culture, why we are in this cultural moment. I am not going to do that with you. They've laid that foundation. I want to get incredibly practical for you. The question is, what are we going to do when we leave this room tomorrow afternoon? What are some practical things, knowing what we know, that we could actually implement tomorrow to make a change with young people? Because this pre-conference is really about training up young people to hold on to the faith. I want to give you a practical approach. I want to remind you, though, before we start, about how bad the situation is. Because we do know, as everyone said, that this culture is walking away from the church in record numbers. So just to give you an idea, a brief snapshot of where we are, the bad news first. Every one of these studies, and I started collecting these studies in 1998. That's when I started collecting these studies. I have one article that's been read probably more than almost every other article on my website, which is just the updated PDF file for all the studies up till about last week that have been done on the flight of young people from the church. As a matter of fact, at the end of this, I'm going to send that to you so you have it as well. It's all hyperlinked, so once you open it on your computer, you'll be able to go to all those surveys, these surveys I'm talking about, to see what the numbers are. And it seems to me that as we started studying this, and I saw this myself, right? I mean, I got saved, and then I was at a big, huge church, and my kids were young. They were like in the first and third grade. And I said, well, we should put them in the Sunday school or their age-appropriate classes while we attend service, right? Which we did. And they didn't like it. They didn't want to be without us. So before long, my wife and I were sitting in these kids' classes with my kids. Well, you know, if you're in church and you're sitting in a kids' class for more than 2 weeks, what's going to happen? I'm now in charge of the class, right? I'm a Christian like 10 minutes, okay? They said, oh, don't worry. We've got curriculum. We'll give it to you. Just read it the night before. You can teach this class. I'm learning how to be a Christian as I'm teaching kids. 2 years later, I am now the coordinator of fifth and sixth graders at our church, which was 550 students over five services. That was my duty. Oh, they got older. I started to get older with them. I just took them on as junior high school pastor at another local church. Then I was the high school pastor for 5 years. And now today, I think about 70% of the audiences that I engage, and I do 70 events a year, are high schoolers or college students. That generation to me is where I think I need to do my work. I watch these numbers. The first graduating class of high schoolers in my youth group, all but one walked away from the faith before Thanksgiving break of their freshman year. And I said, man, I am the worst youth pastor in the history of youth pastors. Then I realized it was a national problem. And even if these numbers are skewed or they're wrong, so look how varied they are. They're pretty varied, right? And these are by every denomination, Assemblies of God, Baptists. I don't care who does the survey. They're always this bad news. Now, let's just throw out the top and let's throw out the bottom. If you want just for sake of art, let's keep the bottom. Let's say it's only 60% that by the time they're in college, they no longer identify as Christians, but they were raised in the church. That would be bad enough news. Would you agree? So let's just assume it's the best it could possibly be based on these surveys. It's still really bad. Bad news. That was the first generation of studies we were doing early on. We wanted to know how bad are the numbers. Now, the second generation of studies I saw come out were studies where we were actually asking young people, why don't you believe it's true anymore? And we were taking their responses. These were not multiple choice. These were open-ended kind of questions. So this is good. It gives us a chance to see inside the mind of those who have already left. I want to show them to you. It's a little more crowded, but I want you to see the kinds of things they said. based on these four surveys, which are the four best surveys I find on this. The most recent one is from February of this year. So these are all the way up to the current time. Now, if you look at that list of objections, you will see that for the most part, it has to do with intellectual skepticism, often grounded in science. Would you agree? So all of these doesn't make any sense to me. I think scientifically there's no real proof of this. I'm a scientist now. I don't believe in miracles. An all-powerful being is less and less believable. It contradicts the rational and scientific world. The last two, though, are interesting. Christians are hypocrites. I've had a bad experience with church. By the way, we often think hypocrisy, Christian hypocrisy, is a huge cause of young people leaving the church. It really isn't when you ask them and you collect their answers. It's part of the answer, but it's not the largest part of the answer. The largest part of the answer is some form of skepticism based on science. At least they're saying that. We'll talk more about that in a minute. But I'm not surprised when I see this. Because I wrote this book, Forensic Faith, I wrote because as I was the first 5 years doing this, I would ask audiences, why are you guys Christians? And I got really three answers over and over and over again, verbalized in different ways. Three answers. The largest group of answers, about 60% I would say or more, where people would say, I'm a Christian because I was raised that way. My parents were Christians. That is by far the most popular answer that any Christian is going to offer nationally. Right? Because we've been speaking 5 years all over the country. And so I just kind of started collecting this data. The second answer is, well, I've had an experience that demonstrated for me, it's usually on the 20th percentile, that demonstrated for me that Christianity is true. A prayer was answered. I saw a miracle. Something, I sense God's presence in my life. Some experiential answer. The third answer is kind of similar to the second. I used to be a jerk. I met Jesus. I'm not so much a jerk anymore. He changed my life. But it's a more experiential answer. Now look, do you realize that those are the same answers that are offered by every theistic believer? Those are the reasons why Buddhists say they're Buddhists, why Muslims say they're Muslim, why Mormons say they're Mormon. As a matter of fact, my dad remarried. He's not a believer. I'm the only Christian in my family. I wasn't raised around Christians. I just became a Christian at 35 because I examined the evidence. That persuaded me. I'm in. Now, I will tell you that his second wife is Mormon. And I have six half-brothers and sisters all raised LDS. And if you ask them, why is this true? They will say the same two answers. I was raised. They won't even. It's always going to be some experience of the Holy Spirit that confirmed for me that Joseph Smith's a prophet of God and the Book of Mormon is true. Now look, if everyone is making different claims about the nature of God that contradict one another, yet everyone says they came to this by way of either being raised in the church or having some experience, really? Maybe that way of becoming a Christian is not sufficient to guard you from error. And then what happens is, when your only reason you can offer why you're a Christian is I was raised this way, or I've had an experience, you get this kind of, your kids are starting to ask these kinds of questions. Because you didn't come to it by way of the evidence, so you can't offer evidential answers. And if it's all about your personal testimony, then we fail because we're all going to fail. We're all fallen humans. The whole thing was about, well, you said you were a Christian. You had this experience. Now you're not. You're being a jerk. And now Christian hypocrisy becomes elevated, right? Because the reason why they got in for some of our kids is they thought that Christians were these good people we're supposed to be. And then when a pastor goes south and they can point to it, or some atheist can point to it, they're shaken because they see Christian hypocrisy. Look, I try to tell my kids up front, I am a hypocrite. By my very nature, this is called sin, okay? I am going to fail you. This is not about me. I can be a jerk. It's still true if it's true. It doesn't matter whether I'm a jerk or represent it well. It's still true if it's true. This is why I think we see these kinds of answers from students. The third generation of surveys we've been doing and collecting, first we said, how bad is the problem? Second, we said, why are they leaving? Third, we said, well, when are they really leaving? Because for a lot of us, we thought, look, we interview these kids when they're like 20. And they'll say, I was raised in the church and I'm no longer in the church. The assumption has always been something bad is happening at university. I was in God's Not Dead 2. God's Not Dead 1 is about what? A kid who goes into a philosophy student, as a philosophy student, into a class in his freshman year, and his faith is challenged by a philosophy professor, right? That's the nature, because the idea was something bad is happening at universities. Well, then we started asking the third question in the most recent surveys. So when exactly did you decide this wasn't true? These are the answers. It's not happening in university. It's happening in junior high and high school. It's happening while they're with us. But they will still attend church with you. They might even identify themselves as a Christian coming out of school. But they have not been with us for a number of years. And afterwards, when you ask them, when did you check out, these huge numbers show up. Most of them leave the faith. You know, it used to be that 85-18 principle. If you didn't reach someone by the age of 18, 85% of Christians became Christians by the age of 18. That is down to 12 years old. Why is that happening? Because it turns out the people that used to impact your students at the age of 18 at university have now got a hold of them by way of the internet as early as 12. So they're leaving us early. So now I started to see the problem more robustly. When I used to talk about this with groups, I used to say there's a sad mathematics in university life. And I pitched it for a number of years this way before these surveys started coming back showing us how early students were leaving. I used to say, here's the problem. The problem is we have underinformed, you know, we have inarticulate students who really cannot talk about theologically what is true about Christianity. We saw this all the time, right? They could not make the case for the triune nature of God. They had a really hard time explaining the substitutionary atonement. In other words, they were not able to articulate their theological positions. They were under-equipped in this area. Then we would introduce them into a hostile university environment, right? That isn't good. Already we see a bad math problem, don't you see? But I would say there's a third thing happening here, which is really the tail that wags the dog, if you ask me, and that is that they are there, away from us, and now they have the desires that all of us have as fallen human beings. We all, hey, listen, I'll tell you what, if you can give me a worldview here at university that allows me to sleep with my girlfriend without feeling bad about it, goodbye Christianity, I'll adopt that worldview, because that's the tail that wags the dog. Are we clear? So I used to say, what do you expect here? We need to do a better job preparing our students for university. Well, now I'm not so sure this is the issue anymore because they're not leaving us then. They're leaving us now. So I kind of rearticulate it this way. It's not that we have an unarticulate. We have an articulate group of students who have been misinformed. That's all. And of course, there's a worldview waiting for them in college that would be happy to welcome these new ex-Christians into a secular worldview. And there they can celebrate their desires as individuals, their autonomy, as Abdu just said. This is the problem. This leads to one result. We all see it already. So the question I have for us as parents, grandparents, as Christian teachers, as youth pastors, as lead pastors, is what can we do to impact this mathematics? We already know the problem. And it's been so well articulated by our speakers this morning, right? Now the question is, what can we do? So I want to offer for you what I think is a solution we could do individually, because all of us are parts of organizations that we think are trying to impact this globally from a philosophical basis. This is what Colson Center does by teaching Christian worldview. This is what Jeff has done at Summit by teaching Christian worldview to students. This is what we do, right? But now I want to say, what can we do in this room? Do we have to become professors at Summit? Do we just make sure all of our kids go to Summit a couple of times? What do we do here? Well, it turns out I think we could do something, and I want to share it with you. Are you ready? The first thing we're going to have to do to stop this problem, to solve this issue, is something that might seem counterintuitive. We need to stop teaching. Teaching doesn't work. We've had great teachers in the church for 2,000 years. We've had great teachers in the church for the last 25 years as this problem has gotten worse and worse and worse. So clearly, it's not a matter of great teaching. His teaching, we're here for a reason. We're in this dilemma for a reason, and we've had great teachers. When I realized this, I stopped teaching. There was no point in it. It was aimless. It was pointless. I stopped teaching, and I started training. Because there's a big difference between these two things. And I moved from teaching models to training models. Now, a lot of that was just because that was my nature as a first responder, right? And from a history of family of first responders, I understood this issue related to training. But I want to teach you the difference between teaching and training. I want to show it to you. So teaching is really about imparting knowledge. I have a set of issues and facts that I hold in my head, of truths that I hold as a teacher, and I want you now to hold these truths as well. So I'm going to impart to you this information to teach you what I know. But that's not training. That's just teaching. Training is about preparing for a battle. That's very different. Boxers train, right? George Foreman, he trained. In between fights, George would get fat. So would Muhammad Ali, Joe Frazier, all these guys, the classic fighters of my generation, they all got fat in between fights. Then they would sign a contract for a fight 12 weeks out. And they would train like crazy for 12 weeks. On the eve of the fight, they're in the best shape of their lives. Why? Because they're about to enter the ring. And they're going to have to be in good shape or they're not going to survive that fight. It turns out all of this has been in preparation for an event that's on the calendar. We have a guy in our city who's got a dojo. You might know this guy. His name is Royce Gracie. He won four of the first five Ultimate Fighting Championships, okay? And Royce is an amazing Brazilian jiu-jitsu fighter. He's a ground fighter. So before anyone could figure this out, the first UFCs, people thought they could box or fight their way or wrestle their way. No, it's all fights eventually come down to the ground. At some point, every fight becomes a ground fight. If you can fight on the ground, it's boring to watch sometimes. But if you can fight on the ground, you're going to win. He knew that before anybody else. Now, he's got a dojo in our city. My son, when he first became a police officer, would go to these kinds of dojos, right? And he would train. And then he would come over to our house for dinner. And one time he comes over to our house for dinner, he's got a big mark on his neck, big bruised mark on his neck. I said, dude, what happened to you? I've been training at the dojo. So how'd it go? He says it was bad. Choked me out in about 30 seconds. About 30 seconds, I was completely choked out. I said, that's not good. That's why I'm training, he said. I've been training there. Okay, great. So we see him about maybe, I don't know, a month later, 6 weeks later. He's got a mark on his forehead. Doesn't look any better to me. I said, dude, was that from training? He says, yeah. I said, you're not getting any better. He says, no, I'm getting better. It took him like 3 minutes to choke me out this time. And I thought, well, you know, that's all you're trying to do as a police officer, is you're trying to stay in the fight for 3 minutes till your backup gets there. If he can get your gun in that first 3 minutes, you're going to be dead. All you're trying to do is to hold on long enough for your backup to get there. That difference between 30 seconds and 3 minutes could be your life. So I was more than happy with that. These guys know how to train. I'm going to teach you the principles of training this morning so you will know how to train. Because I think we could do this as parents. We could certainly do this as youth pastors, as youth leaders, as Christian educators. We could do this if we chose to. So here are the five things that I think are incumbent about training. If you do these five things, you have shifted from one category of just imparting information to a second category of actually training your young people. These five things. I will send you, by the way, this entire video in a much longer version. So if you don't like taking notes, don't take notes. I'm going to send all this to you so you can download it. All the PDF files, all the MP3s, and the video you can download to your computer so you can hold on to it, okay? Let's get after it. The first thing you got to do is you got to test. You got to challenge yourself. Look, we have a bar in our agency called The Crest. It's a biker bar. It's fights here every night, drunk bikers fighting each other every night, okay? If you got a training car who's working anywhere in the city, he's going to have an FTO, a field training officer. That's what my son does now. He's training recruits. And they're going to buy this call because we're going to send our trainee over there, and the FTO is going to get out of the car with the trainee, and he's going to do this to see if this trainee can handle a bar fight, number one. And number two, can he figure out who's lying and who's telling the truth? And I mean, that's a great place to see. And all of us have been in one of those situations where we got there and we got beat up. And he's going to jump in. He's not going to just get hurt. But we saw in that first moment that we're not ready yet. We thought we were ready, but something south will happen. And then we realize we're not ready. Because at night, every one of these becomes a place to test officers. And you don't get anywhere with an officer until you start with a test. Because every new officer has to be tested to know what it is they need to train in, or at least to have the incentive to train well. That's why if you ask me to come out and work with your youth group, I am happy to come. But that first day, I don't want you to introduce me as J. Warner Wallace. I want you to introduce me as the local professor at your university who teaches philosophy. Because I want to be able to test your students. Because they're going to start off all smiley and happy, but by the time I'm done with them in 30 minutes, they're going to be miserable because I'm going to show them that they don't know anything about their view. I'm going to challenge them in a number of ways. I did this with Jimmy, who sat through my youth groups for years, and I had him come in. We were at Chuck Smith's church, Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa. We're training up their youth group to go to a missions trip in England. So they asked me to do four or five sessions. First session, they knew who I was. So I brought in my son, playing a role as one of my students in youth group who has left the faith. And then Jimmy explained to them why he was no longer a Christian and took answers and questions from these students. And they tested, and he just pushed all of their buttons. They couldn't even answer a single objection he was leveling, to the point where the principal at the school, who happened to be in the same room, who stupidly we did not tell Jimmy was role-playing, right? We didn't tell him this. We should have. He's now angry that this young college student is able to twist his high schooler so badly on issues of science and evolution. So he stands up and makes a claim about how evolution can't get the job done on a certain issue. And Jimmy just calmly said, well, you know, the problem is you don't really seem to understand evolution. Let me explain it to you. Oh my gosh, he was livid. At the end of this, we asked two questions of our groups that we do this with. Number one, how well do you think you did on a scale of 1 to 5 defending your faith? People will say, can we use negative numbers? No. 1 is as low as you can go. Well, everyone's going to say, we did 1. But number two, how did you treat the atheist who's here visiting you? Were you kind to him? This principal was so upset with Jimmy that he berated him in front of all these people. Afterwards, I knew I had to reveal he's a real Christian who's just here to show you what you don't know. And I felt terrible because now this principal's got to come up and say, hey, I'm sorry, I didn't know. And I apologized to him. I said, no, that never should have happened. We should have identified you early and told you up front this was actually a role play. You have to do the same thing here that you do with all students, is put them in an uncomfortable position. The same way you have to test officers to know what they don't know, we have to start with a test with students so they can know what they don't know. And it all comes down to this. This is how I drew it in forensic faith. I have this weird background, right? My bachelor's degree is in design. My master's is in architecture. And then I went on to law enforcement. And then I came out of that and went into theology, right? So I get to draw my own books, though. So I drew this in forensic faith. The idea here is if you start with a test, now you know what you need to study to get ready for the task. Frustrating tests are the starting point for future tasks. Does that make sense? We got to start with a test. Now, what would they be for us? Well, look, I designed a 21-minute test in forensic faith that you can get online for free. I'll send this all to you. Don't worry about that. And in this test, I simply ask you, if you had 3 minutes to answer each of these questions, what would you say in response to each of these 7 questions? You have 21 minutes to answer them. Imagine you're back and forth with somebody on social media. You have 21 minutes to answer these 7 questions. And by the way, once you start answering these questions, trust me, you'll realize I need to do a little studying because I'm not really ready to answer those questions. The church for sure is not ready. You're probably at a position where you're here for Wilberforce weekend where you're the best of the best. But the church is definitely not ready for this. Starts with a test. Know what you don't know. Second thing we talked about, and John talked about this, is we have to require more of our students than they think they can do, than we have thought in the past that they could achieve. We have to raise the bar for our students. I've been that guy working with an upstart church plant trying to grow a youth ministry, and my pastor wanted me to get one thing done, get students to attend. I get that. So what would I do? Well, I started thinking about it. How am I going to get students to show up? Well, I know. Same thing every youth pastor does. I'm going to feed them like crazy and play a lot of games. And I did that for years. We all done. If you're a youth pastor in this room or if you worked with youth ministry, you know this. We've done this, okay? I get it. Now, meanwhile, at home, as parents, we require a lot more of our students. Some of my students were AP students, advanced placement. Some of my students were international baccalaureate, IB students. These guys and gals were being sent to tutors to get their grades up in certain high-level courses. Their parents expected that, and they met that challenge. Some of my students were just really good athletes, and their parents would send them to camps and to coaches. They would raise their game athletically. Meanwhile, at church, we are playing games. You don't think they can accomplish this? Well, they haven't been tested, because once they've been tested and they look really bad in front of their friends, they're like, I'm going to change that. I'm going to fix that. Now we can start training. These are my family. Susie's sitting in the back here. She came with me this trip. This is when our kids were starting in youth ministry as a youth pastor. These were the age of my students. My oldest was only 12. The guy's a cop now. He was only 12 years old. Now, I was doing high schoolers. So the high schoolers were like, my boys loved it because they thought of themselves older anyway, so they would sit with the high school boys. They loved that. And my girls would sit in the laps of the high school girls who would kind of take care of them. My kids would not go to their age-appropriate classes at our church. They wanted to sit with mom and dad. So they would just hang out with us. And that meant I was teaching the high schoolers at a college level. I expected them to pull up to that level. But meanwhile, I had these younger kids in the same room. Now, years passed by, right? And they all grew older. And all of them have been in my classes. I know Abigail is here with John Stone Street. His daughter's here, so make sure you say hi to her. And our kids ended up sitting in our talks. By the time they were this age, they would tell me, I could do all your talks. I've heard them 1,000 times. I could do them better. I think I'm funnier than you are. My daughter told me that one day. I said, really? So these kids had been catching everything I had been teaching at a college level, and they were in elementary and junior high. It turns out our kids can do more than you think they can do. This is them now at Jimmy's wedding. Yes, my daughter Mia is in the Marine Corps. She's stationed at Pendleton. She wants to be a police officer also. She's in the MP program there, so she's guarding the gate at Camp Pendleton right now. Here's my point. We start targeting at a higher level, because we know that at that higher college level, my high schoolers can handle that. And then I learned that it was ricochet apologetics. I was teaching Christian worldview, and my kids were catching it. This is possible. My question for all of us is, how high are you aiming? For your own kids, how much are you expecting of your own kids? We've got to start arming them. And what I mean by that is we have to start giving them the tools that are necessary for them to be successful. Look, we would never think about putting officers in the field without tools. And we don't do that. We give them a number of tools. But even more importantly, we train them how to use each tool. And so it's a matter of tools and training, information on how to use these tools. Now it comes to our students, and it's time to release them to university. I want to make sure that as they're growing up, I do the same thing. And we talked about this a little bit. Jeff talked about it in terms of viruses of ideas, right? What I'm trying to do is to inoculate as much as I can. I want to expose my students to the ideas before they get there. When they hear bad ideas, I want them to hear them first from me. So I can show them the idea is bad and why it's bad before we go to the next level of trying to correct the bad idea. And of course, I'm going to have to show them the bad idea in the context of what's being written that is against the faith. So when I was a youth pastor, this was required reading for one of the trips we would take. And they would have to read through these things. And then, of course, we would come back and talk about what is true against this lie. But we inoculated them at least with having heard the lie from us. Not for the first time while they're in a college campus. Make sense? Or the first time while they're surfing on the web at the age of 12. I want to be able to talk about these ideas. Now, we're going to talk about what is true and then how to defend what is true. So we're going to go through lots of materials. Of course, the best materials that are out there are these three books right here. Just so you know. But you get the idea, right? I wrote about this in Forensic Faith. This is a student who wrote to me. He's a pastor. His son, his name is Andrew Dean. Here's what he said. He said, my dad was a Southern Baptist preacher. And while I was growing up, I basically lived at the church, which you probably recognize from a lot of preachers' kids. I knew all the Bible stories and was even baptized when I was 8. After graduating high school, I went to college to get a degree in mechanical engineering. Now, one might think a degree of this kind would involve little or no discussion of whether or not God exists or if Jesus was a real person. But I encountered these and many more objections. I had a literature class where the professor gave a presentation on how Jesus was copied from other gods and how this explained away the mythology of Jesus. I had an electromagnetics course in which the professor viciously attacked the concept of intelligent design. I had a space technology class in which the professor vehemently argued for the existence of aliens but refused to acknowledge the existence of God. These are just a few examples from the many interactions I have with my professors. Unfortunately, many of our fellow brothers and sisters in Christ are severely lacking in training. And when they encounter even the weakest arguments, they're not prepared. As a Christian in the college setting, you're being constantly challenged, constantly poked and prodded. It's easy to throw your hands up in the air, becoming convinced your faith is a lie, when you're being trampled every day by both professors and by peers. All Christians, but especially ones in college, must know what they believe and why they believe it if they have any hope of surviving with their faith intact. I think of college, hear this, almost like an atheist ambush. The Christians are walking in totally unaware of the danger until it's too late and damage has already been done. That's why I wanted to take the time to thank you. When I entered college, I was struggling with many of the objections I encountered. I discovered your podcast and your careful research. The evidentiary approach was incredibly helpful. We want to be able to do this with our students. We know that if we say, look, we're just going to shield them from bad ideas, we're not going to share them with them, we're not going to try to inoculate them, we're just going to shield them while we're here, keep their eyes, keep their blinders on, keep them off the internet, keep them off their phones, well, that's fine, but when they get to university or they get out in the real world with their friends, they are not going to be shielded. And all that protection you've offered them is going to be exposed. On the other hand, if we were to inoculate them first with these ideas, then when they get into any other setting, wherever it is, they are already shielded from bad ideas because they already know why they aren't true. But that means you're going to have to do this work first for yourself. I say it a lot. We do not need another million-dollar apologist on a stage or writing a book. We need a million $1 apologists who are the parents of these students. They don't care about my book. They want to know how you answer the objection. So the question is, what are you reading? Where are you spending your free time? I want to give you this most important step. You have to involve students. To train them, this is the one thing that shifts teaching to training. We've tested them. We've shown them what they need. We now have raised the bar and begun to arm them with something. Now the question is, what is the scheduled fight? What is the scheduled battle that turns teaching into training? It's all about involving people in the battlefield of ideas. So I want to talk about what that might look like. Look, this is our agency. If I could handle every call for service from our dispatch room, would I ever care to stay in shape? Would I ever care to learn how to use my weapons or my tactics? No, I wouldn't. If I could handle every call from the office, from dispatch, on the phone, I would never train. If you have no intention of deploying, there's no point in training. Do you see the problem? Same is true for us as a church. If we have no intention of deploying, there's no point in training. I could teach you how to wrestle, just stay on the chalkboard. I could. I could just say, you know what? Here we are. We'll stay on the chalkboard. Well, I'll tell you what, if you do that, that's not going to help you. You got to get on the mat at some point. This is how you're going to change it. You're going to change it by actually getting on the mat. I'll just show it to you right here. You might say to yourself, you know what? It's really all about how much theology I learned. No, it's not here you're going to change it. You're going to change it with a calendar. You're going to change this with your calendar. We started scheduling trips. I want to teach my students theology. I'll take them to Salt Lake City. There we're going to evangelize a group that has changed every key word of Christianity and subtly altered it. This trip, putting students on the field, talking to Mormons, going door-to-door in the city of Provo, being on the campus of Salt Lake City, on the campus of BYU, talking to students at in the food court. This forced them to get ready. We tested them, then we trained them up to this 6 days in Salt Lake City. This is only for theology. I wanted to teach them philosophy too. So what did we do? The same thing that I think it was Abdu who said in Berkeley. How about if I told you guys you're going to go to Berkeley and you're going to be speaking on the campus? You think you'd have to get ready? Our students knew they would spend 6 days on the campus of Berkeley having to evangelize and reach out to people who are from atheist groups. There's a large number of atheist groups. Every night after this was over, our students would be back in the dorms studying, tormented by the fact they were unable to make any progress with the people they were talking to. Now they are training. Now they are engaged. I just put them in bed at 2 o'clock in the morning. Go to bed. I want to go to bed. You go to bed. By the way, tomorrow you're going to meet somebody with an entirely new objection. This is all a waste of time. I don't want to tell them that. But just go to bed. This is what we're hoping to see. This is what turns teaching into training. It's battlefields. Could you schedule a battlefield? I'm just going to leave you with this before I get off the stage. Yes, we need to schedule battlefields. We do. Simple as this. You could take your students, your kids, on any local campus. We've got a handout in the book, which is just a survey. Take that survey and start talking to people. You'll see it'll open up spiritual conversations. You could do that. You could even start a class at your church. A lot of you have no apologetics training at your church at all right now. But if you started and you became a teacher, trust me, you will get ready. You'll have to get ready to teach that class. Start a class. All of us could do that. Start working with your youth group. We used to do a family evidence night on Sundays with a big whiteboard. I'd get a big whiteboard out, and I would teach some principle of evidence. That meant I had to be ready to teach that principle of evidence to my own kids. That will get you training. We have an event that's scheduled. You've got groups. You know how many groups? It's easy to start a group on Facebook. And if you do that, it's going to get you in conversations. And then guess what? You're going to find yourself training to get ready for the next conversation. These are simple ways that we can actually get in the game. How about this? Put on your calendar. Somebody you know needs to hear the gospel. Put on the calendar when you're going to share it. Stop waiting. Someday I'm going to do that. No, put it on your calendar. And suddenly you'll be getting ready for that event. You'll start training. That's the difference. Training, after you test, you calendar that event. Everything you do prior to the event is a shift from teaching into training. I'm going to run out of time, but I want to just say that last thing is really about nurturing. That's the end. It's about nurturing. But as I close, I wanted to show this to you. Look, folks, this is an expression we use all the time. Talk is cheap. You know where that comes from, talk is cheap? That comes from Scripture. Yeah, that's from Ecclesiastes. King Solomon said that. Talk is cheap, like daydreams and other useless activities. Fear God instead. My question for all of us as we leave this event tomorrow is, what are we going to do on the backside of this event? Clearly, God did not call you to come to events like this. He called you to use these events to equip you to get ready to do something else. What is the other thing you're called to do? We are called to do something. The question is, what are you waiting for? Just do something. Put it on your calendar. Get ready to do it. And you'll turn teaching into training.
Thanks for listening to the Breakpoint Podcast. We have J. Warner Wallace's books, including Forensic Faith, at our online bookstore at breakpoint.org. And be sure to secure your place at next year's Wilberforce Weekend and take advantage of our early bird pricing. You can register at wilberforceweekend.org.